Hello. My name is Misha. I forgot to do a who am I slide, so who am I and why am I talking to you about brains? I have a degree in neuroscience. I graduated in the pandemic and needed to do something else, and I like to mess around with computers. And then they're like, do you want to give a talk on brain-computer interfaces? And yes, of course. So this is Why Don't I Know Kung Fu Yet? Brain-computer interfaces, human memory, and the implications of those things from a cybersecurity perspective. Now, we were promised in sci-fi that we were going to be able to upload our brains, have copies of us, we're going to have be brains in jars, we're going to have robot bodies, we're going to be able to browse the internet with our minds, we can use Google search, use and control robots quicker than we can think a thought ourselves. And also, we can just learn languages by, like, plugging some memory into our brains. Ta-da, you know French or Kung Fu. But it's not actually like that. And it's 2023. We've had a lot of time. Computers have been around for a while. Why haven't we got there yet? So we're going to have to start off with looking at how the brain works. So I'm going to do a very, very reductionist kind of simplified version of how the brain works, and we're going to start with neurons. So sorry to crush everyone's dreams, your brain is not a computer. Your brain is made up of lots of types of cells, but the workhorse cells are neurons. These neurons are a bit like wires. They're excitatory cells. They're why people compare neurons to an electrical cell. You have an action potential, which starts at one end of the neuron, at the dendrite, and goes in one direction from one end to the other. And then when it gets to the other end, it causes a change to happen. What that change is depends on the type of neuron and on a lot of different factors, as we're going to look at. But it's not just the wires. So between each neuron, there's a gap between one neuron and the next. This gap is called the synapse. At these gaps, what tends to happen is that your action potential wave will arrive, and this will cause chemical messengers called neurotransmitters to be released across the gap and then be taken up by the synapse on the other side, and then sometimes not, start an action potential in the next neuron. But there's not only neurons in the brain, there's other types of cell. So there's glial cells. Glial cells in some areas of the brain are in a 1-to-1 ratio with neurons. In others, they outnumber neurons 10-to-1. Despite the Latin meaning glue, they're more than just glue. They do things like provide neurotransmitters for the neurons. They provide support to neurons, both structural and metabolic support. They also can speed up or slow down transmission along a neuron. So even if we modeled all of the synapses between all of the neurons in the brain, we couldn't model a brain without modeling glial cells. Also, synapses aren't the only type of junction between neurons. There's also things like gap junctions or other types of signaling, like cell protein signaling for immune system function and things like that. So assuming that you could model every single interaction between every single neuron in the brain, you still wouldn't have a computational model of the brain. So, what does this mean about memories? Because the idea is that we just want to be able to add in extra memory. We want to be able to plug in a USB and have extra memory space. And after all, some people say that you remember everything that you've ever seen. This isn't true. Memory in humans is quite complicated, but basically, we take in information from the world, and then that information is processed and becomes a memory, moves into our long-term memory in an area of the brain called the hippocampus. And the way that these memories are stored is via a method called long-term potentiation. And if you get enough long-term potentiation, you actually then get the growth of new neurons. And so this is what's associated with the long-term potentiation, is associated with the starting of like forming new memories. It's like when you're just moving things from like things you've just heard to moving into your longer term memory. But memory in humans, unlike in computers, is incredibly unreliable. As I said, the majority of the information that we process is completely forgotten. Things like we don't tend to process the motion blur as we move our eyes. Unless you have a brain injury, your brain will just filter that out. That's why sometimes you feel really dizzy after you've hit your head. It's that your brain isn't doing a good job of filtering out that motion blur. But also, it's really, really easy to induce false memories. A study showed that if you doctor a photo of someone going for a hot air balloon ride when they're a kid, more than 50% of people will not just tell you that they think they remember going on this hot air balloon ride when they're about 7. They will be convinced that they remember going on it. They're sure that they've been on it, when in fact, they just haven't. It's just something that you've seen a photo of. So how does this relate to technology? Well, recently, as in within the past 10 years, we've been able to use our understanding of the metabolic function of long-term potentiation to disrupt this formation of memories. So we can do something called optogenetics, which means that we tie the functioning of certain chemicals to light exposure, and then use that to interrupt or replace or recondition fear memories that have already been induced during a previous scenario. But like, that's all well and good, and it's very useful. And a lot of research has been put into this, and here is a very beautiful colorized picture of the neurons in a hippocampus of a mouse, with each one individually being tied to a particular memory. But should we really be messing with these memories? I mean, if we can locate particular memories and interrupt them, do we want to? Does it mean that our own memories aren't secure anymore? Can we trust our own memories? And do we want to live in a world where that option of just deleting or editing memories is a thing that we can do as humanity? Understandably, there've been a lot of research in the defense industries with this, which all the research papers do assure you that it's just to help PTSD, no other reason. But memory goes beyond the cellular. Brains aren't just single cells, they're networks. The brain and neurons within the brain work in these kind of feedback loops. There's reinforcing feedback loops, and then there's inhibitory feedback loops. And these neuronal tracks and loops have a really complex interplay with each other. As we've seen, neurons are unidirectional, so they can only go in one way. So that means if you want a loop to inhibit something or strengthen something, you're going to need two loops of neurons. So that means that it's incredibly complex, and all of these neuronal loops interact with other neuronal loops next to them and are always changing. So even if we could model all of these loops, it would be billions and billions of functions, meaning that we just don't have the computing power yet to even begin to model them. For instance, this is an incredibly pretty picture taken just down the road using MRI data. And this is just showing the paths that connect the two hemispheres of the brain. The different colors are, as I said, unidirectional. So different colors are showing paths going in different directions. So even if we can image every single neuronal connection and pathway in the brain, it doesn't really mean that we've made a computer model of the brain, and it wouldn't really be capable of thinking. So that's why we can't really just plug in extra memory like adding some hard drives. Another reason is neuroplasticity. So historically, it was thought that our brains develop as we age, and then by the time we get to sort of late teens, mid-20s, that stops, and then you've got all the neurons you have for your life. That's how it is. Your brain is in a solid state now, much like the heart. But it turns out that, in fact, the opposite is true. Neurons are being removed and changed and grown all the time across the entire brain. And so even if we could make a map of every single neuronal and glial connection at a point in time that was activated, it wouldn't be able to account for this neuroplasticity. We just have a static snapshot rather than a working model. So yeah, brain uploads and memory additions aren't possible, but that doesn't mean that we can't communicate with computers directly via our brains. So what about brain-computer interfaces? Because we can measure brain activity really easily, as we've just seen. We can point direct neuronal communications inside our brains, but like, why is brain-computer interface technology even being developed? Like, surely we can just use a keyboard and mouse, right? Like, why would we even bother? Well, brain-computer interfaces allow us to interact with computers in new ways. The majority of brain-computer interface research has been looking for people with motor disabilities that might find it difficult to use other forms of interacting with a computer, such as typing on a keyboard or using eye gaze. Also, a good brain-computer interface should be intuitive. It shouldn't take a long time to use. But what options do we have? So, the first option is electroencephalography-based brain-computer interfaces. Now, EEG has been around for an incredibly long time. It's been around since the 1800s. It's detecting brain waves. So, for instance, it's used a lot in healthcare for detecting sleep disorders or epilepsy, and is where neurons fire in sync with each other and create waves of particular amplitudes of neuronal fire. So, what are the advantages and disadvantages of using EEG brain-computer interfaces? So on the plus side, it's non-invasive. You don't have to have any brain surgery, so there's no risk of infection or anything using EEG. But you do have to wear a silly hat. This is an example of open BCIs. EEG-based monitoring system. It uses particular EEG combs that are designed to work through hair. A common problem with older EEG caps is that they are fitted very tight to your head, which was uncomfortable. You looked even sillier, in my opinion, and it meant that you had to have no hair. Which, if you're really, really dedicated to BCI, or you just want to go for that shaved head look, is great. But if that's not for you, then EEG can be a bit unreliable. As well as this, like, unreliability, you have to learn how to use it. Modulating your brain waves isn't something that comes naturally to most people, so a lot of people that use EEG BCI have to spend a long time training to think in the right way to modulate their brain waves to be read as particular inputs by the computer system. Also, it adds an extra cognitive step to interacting with the computer via your brain, which kind of takes away the point of a brain-computer interface anyway. It's not intuitive, and it's very difficult to do. Only certain people can do it. Also, it takes up thinking area in your brain, physically. These were developed, a lot of people with like spinal cord injuries, so they could use the motor cortex and the premotor cortex by thinking about moving different parts of their body to control the BCI. But if you still have your arm and leg working, you don't want to have to also move your arm and leg while you're trying to control the computer, because then just type, it's easier most of the time. Also, there's only a certain number of inputs you can have based on the number of electrodes, and it's not very precise and it's quite slow. It takes quite a lot of brain activity in one area to be picked up. So it's not really ideal. It's difficult to get more than about sort of 20 to 30 inputs, even with a really, really well-trained EEG BCI device. So what other options do we have? Okay. So word of the day, electrocorticography. Electrocorticography is placing an array of electrodes on the surface of the brain. So this does involve literal brain surgery. To have these electrodes implanted, you need to remove the skull and the dura and actually place these electrodes on the surface of the brain. This is what Elon Musk is trying to do with things like Neuralink, although so far he's doing it with moderate success. This has many advantages over EEG-based systems. One is that it's implanted. It's not affected by you actually being there next to the EEG machine. It's not affected by movement, such as eye blinks or sneezing or coughing. And it also is a lot more precise, both in terms of space and in terms of temporally precise. It's a lot quicker to respond. Also, it allows for a much more intuitive way of interacting with the computer. So most people have a voice in their head. You can think of your own internal thoughts and hear them. This creates activation on the surface of your neocortex, which helpfully for this is on the outside of your brain. So it means you don't have to put the interface inside the brain and you can just lay it across the top, a bit like a hat. So it means that you can, if you have enough precision and enough electrodes, and if we're able to decode what different activation areas correspond to which phonemes, particularly in English, which is the language it's been tested in the most, we should be able to just think and have those thoughts be interpreted by the computer directly without having to go through an extra step. This would make it much faster and incredibly intuitive, and also mean it would be great for people with things like locked-in syndrome or ALS that are unable to use normal forms of communication like sign language or speech, and at the moment have to use techniques such as using eye gaze based AAC, which can often be really slow and time consuming. It would also just be really cool, but unfortunately even using the best neural networking systems to model which areas of the brain are activated during which phoneme use, we've so far only got to about 30% of the correct phonemes being identified. One of the areas that this really needs more research into is looking at different languages using BCIs. So it would be very possible to use the inner ear and parts of the brain associated with tonal processing to allow more discrimination on tonal-based languages such as Mandarin Chinese. But unfortunately, not much research has been done into this type of brain interface with these languages as of yet. But hopefully that's something that will happen in the future. I say hopefully, and half my talk's been pretty depressing. It's been about how all your future dreams are not actually going to come true and you can't just upload your mind. But do we really want to? This is a world where we're pushing the boundaries of medical technology when there's the vast majority of people don't have access to basic healthcare like vaccines and antibiotics. Do we really want to just have these sorts of technology be developed for the very few people that can actually afford them? Especially more so in for-profit healthcare systems like the US and Canada. Is it right that these technologies are being developed just on the off chance that one or two incredibly wealthy people can afford them? Already today, we've seen what happens when medtech devices just aren't repaired and the company that owns them just goes bankrupt and decides they're going to keep their closed source code and, well, sorry, your eye doesn't work anymore. You'll just have to deal with that. And what about repairing them? Should it be different for brain-computer interfaces? We don't have the right to repair yet for things like insulin pumps or electric wheelchairs. And we can often pay thousands out of pocket for, frankly, really old technology just because we need licensing keys. And what if that happens to the actual memories in your brain or your actual ability to think? I mean, do we really want that? Also, what about the security implications? So, who's responsible for the data in your memory if you have a BCI? If your data's compromised in your BCI because the security of the implant itself is compromised, is that just the implant compromised or is it you as a person? And if you think, well, the implant's compromised, then the person's compromised because their brain's compromised. What about when someone has a stroke or a brain injury? Does that mean that they're less of a person? And who do you want to be responsible for maintaining your supposed brain upload? I mean, sure, you can own the software, but what about the hardware? What about the electricity needed to run the stimulation? And who owns the right to copies of your data? Sure, you might be fine with a theoretical version of you being used like once or twice, or to solve some interesting mathematical problems for like 10 or 20 times. What about 50,000? What about 100,000? What does it do to a human psyche if they have the knowledge that that's happened? What about time? On fictional works, things like copyright expire after 100 years. Do you still own the copyright to your own memories and to your own sense of self? And what about if you have ethical disagreements for what your copy of yourself and your brain is being used for? Because, you know, if you have an ethical disagreement for the calculation that you're being used for, say you're being used for whatever the future version of crypto mining is, that's fine. We'll just turn you off, right? So I hope I've left you all with some interesting philosophical questions, and like me, you're both sad and glad that we're not in robot bodies yet. Thanks for listening, and if you've got any questions or you want to just get really existential about what happens when there's robots, do come and talk to me later. None of the images I used in my presentation were mine. Here are all the references for them, and obviously the credit goes to their respective owners. Thanks very much. Does anyone have any questions?
When you talk about false memories that
yeah.
can be implanted, do they end up functioning the same as genuine memories? Like, are they indistinguishable?
Yeah, false memories are indistinguishable from real memories. Human memory is actually incredibly easy to falsify. You don't when it comes to creating false memories, you don't actually need any fancy optogenetics. You just need some convincing. This has led to a lot of problems in things like eyewitness testimonies, and in many court cases. It was thought for a long time that you couldn't have false memories. Everything you remembered must be real on some level. And this has actually been incredibly disruptive in the past and has led to a lot of like really interesting, if difficult, like legal and political cases in the past.
When police officers in the US are told to shout, "Stop, drop your weapon," after firing,
yeah,
because it will always be remembered that they shouted it and shot, so they'll put it in an order that makes sense, which would be they said to stop and then shot.
Maybe the problem is the system.
Perhaps. Maybe we should not rely on unreliable testimony.
And on the police.
True.
Hasn't witness testimony been like actually actual eyewitness testimony has pretty much rendered very
unreliable. For the average person, yes, but security guards and police officers have specific training in what to identify and what to memorize.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, you can train.
You can train to be better at it, but it's still only just better. It's like if you play a perfect game of blackjack, you're still only at a 55% chance of winning. It's better than average, but not great. Oh, yeah.
What's involved in a person learning how to modulate the signals?
So learning to modulate brainwaves comes under a class of training called biofeedback. Basically, it can be done with learning to modulate things like breathing and heart rate to an extent with those two. But you'd see a real-time recording of your EEG. And then it would be relatively random, the brain waves that you produce at the start. But then you'd learn to associate what feelings come with what particular brain waves being produced. And then so over time, you'd develop better memories and create more long-term potentiation around those particular memories to induce those sets of brainwaves. So it's a skill you can learn, and it usually takes, for training to use an EEG-based BCI, it usually takes about 2 to 3 months of practicing for like about an hour to 2 hours a day. It's spaced throughout the day. It's doable, but it's not what sci-fi says it should be. It's not, I put it on and then suddenly I can use it right away. It's, yeah. Does anyone else have any other questions?
Regarding the helmet you mentioned earlier on,
yes.
The one was, I think it was an open, like open source one.
Yes.
How easily reproducible are those?
So the...
Like,
it's the one other models are available. I just used OpenBCI because they were the first one that came up when I was making my slide deck. But yes, you can buy or make these standard electrode caps that don't work that well if you have hair, really, really easily. And you can 3D print the electrodes for use with hair and the electrode array caps pretty easily. They're basically literally clicked together in most cases. It was designed to make BCI like more accessible to the public and to people on lower incomes, so those on disability incomes at the moment, for instance.
Cool.
Yeah.
I've been shown the one that you have. I'm sorry, but Zach Rubin, I have very different opinions on what is considered a low income and affordable cheese.
Just
the chip for reference is about $850.
Yes, there's...
It is open source hardware, and if you go, you get your first board free from JLCPC.
Yeah.
We're
in the
It's cheap in terms of medical tech, but it's incredibly expensive. But anyway, thank you.